Broadwood Productions presents Chuck Connors, Glenn Ford, Olivia Hussey, George Kennedy, Masao Kusakari, Edward J. Olmos, Henry Silva, Bo Svensson, and Robert Vaughn. Silhouetted against a glaring white sky, a lone figure limps along a ridge. Clothing hangs in shreds from his gaunt frame. He leans on his walking stick to face the sun. Virus. With faltering footsteps, the figure continues on his way. A winter wind blows through a fenced compound. In the darkness, three lights illuminate a security booth at the Leipzig, East Germany Bacteriological Research Institute. Standing in front of a barricade, a guard waves an approaching car to a stop.
Herr Professor?
The guard glances into the car, then closes the door and signals a colleague to raise the barricade. The snow-covered car drives through the gate. The guard enters his booth and places a phone call. The car turns into a driveway and comes to a stop beside a house. The professor gets out of his car, carrying a metal canister in the crook of his elbow. Two men escort him to the house. Inside, a man sitting at a candlelit table turns to the door as the professor and his escorts enter. The man stands to face them.
How nice to see you. Dreadfully cold, no? Here, warm yourself.
The professor walks over to the table.
I trust everything is in order.
The professor sits at the table, then carefully twists the canister with both hands. He removes the top and sets it down. He then takes off a safety cap and delicately lifts out a frosty glass cylinder. His host reaches for the cylinder, but the professor waves him off.
It is agreed, then. The contents are to be delivered directly to Dr. Leisenau of the Viral Research Institute at Zurich.
His host nods as the professor places the cylinder back into its container.
Transport it exactly as it is. Under no circumstances take it out with the dry ice packing. Under no circumstances allow the dry ice to run out. It's set perfectly, absolutely clear.
You expect me to take this to Dr. Leisenau with no proof? No idea of its characteristics, its properties? Here, Dr. Leisenau, here is a germ. Fix it, please.
It is more than a germ. It is a weapon. MM88 is an accident. It is a Frankenstein monster masquerading as a virus.
MM88.
Soon after it was found, we could take DNA apart and reassemble it in different ways. An American geneticist developed this MM88. When we heard of its characteristics, we decided to borrow some of it.
What characteristics?
Essentially, it is a mimic.
A what?
A mimic attaches itself to existing viruses, such as polio, influenza, etc., increasing both the toxicity level and the reproductive level of the host disease. In other words, it hits so hard and multiplies so fast, it simply overwhelms any vaccine known.
Ah! Excuse.
You have a cold?
No, it's nothing.
If I were to open this ampule to the air, you would be dead within 3 days. Unless a way is found to neutralize this monster, we are left with a doomsday weapon.
Outside, a jeep pulls up to the house, followed by a truck. Soldiers jump from the back of the truck and walk toward the house. Inside.
You've done well. In 5 days, a bank account will be opened in your name in Brazil. £50,000 will be deposited to that account.
The professor leans over the man.
You think I did this for money? I want you to get this virus to Dr. Leisenau, nothing more.
The soldiers burst through the door. The soldiers sweep the room with flashlights. The professor lies dead on the floor, shot through the eye. Later, a small airplane pitches from side to side as it flies over a mountain range. Inside.
You are certain Professor Krauser was hit?
Yes.
Just as well, I suppose. He wouldn't have been very happy if he found out we were not representing the good Dr. Leisenau, after all.
The plane shudders violently.
We gotta go higher! Give us cover!
No, we picked up by radar. Keep hugging the cliff!
Damn safe! We're too late!
The plane slams into a mountainside and explodes in an inferno of orange flame. Thrown clear, the canister shatters on a rock. The broken glass tube inside releases the MM88 virus to the wind. 1 month later, a black limousine drives through a parking lot at the University of Maryland, USA. The limousine pulls to a stop outside the Institute for Biological Research. Inside, a man in a lab coat sits at a desk, typing. Removing a letter from his typewriter, he looks it over. Startled, he slips the letter beneath a newspaper.
Come in.
A civilian and a colonel enter the room.
Director Rogers.
Dr. Meyer, you have a visitor.
How are you, Ed? You busy?
No, I wasn't expecting you till tomorrow.
I came by to check on your progress.
Well, I've a few things to do, gentlemen, so if you'll excuse me.
Rogers leaves the room.
Did you get it back?
No. A scientist named Krauss was making discreet inquiries to the Swiss about something that sounded like MM88. I sent in some of my people posing as Swiss. They never came out.
Well, send in some more, damn it! It's vitally important to find out who stole that virus.
My only link was Krauss. These Germans are saying that he committed suicide. So MM88 is still out there, and we don't know where. That's why it is imperative for you to develop a vaccine against it immediately.
There's not a vaccine in the world that can stop it. Not likely to be one either.
Dr. Meyer closes the curtains, picks up a remote control, and switches on a slide projector.
At extremely low temperatures, the virus is completely dormant. But at minus 10 degrees centigrade, it begins to reproduce itself. By minus 3 degrees centigrade, its reproductive rate is increased by a factor of 100. Above zero, it starts growing at a horrendous rate, reaching its peak infectivity at about 5 degrees centigrade, at which time its reproductive rate, the speed with which it multiplies, reaches massive proportions. Its reproductive rate is now something on the order of 2 billion times greater than what it was at minus 10. Look at this, and look at this, and look at this.
Dr. Meyer turns the projector off.
I'm scared to death of this thing. It's not just a vaccine you want to develop from this little monster of ours, is it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
I know how the system works, Colonel. You develop part of a weapon here, another part over there, the trigger someplace else again, and nobody involved even knows what the hell they're working on until it's all put together.
Go on.
Militarily, a vaccine would be a very useful defensive element.
And that is all you're being asked to develop.
Come off it, Colonel. Why is Columbia being asked to do a study on MM88's resistance to extreme heat? You are developing a weapon system based on MM88, aren't you?
The Colonel steps over to Meyer's desk.
Ed, at this moment, we do not have a creditable deterrent in the United States arsenal.
At this moment, we are capable not only of reducing each other to rubble, but of reducing the rubble to rubble.
We were. Before we install the automatic reaction system, the ARS.
So how does that leave us defenseless?
The Soviets install the same system. Now neither side can employ their missiles even if they want to. So this...
He grabs Meyer's newspaper.
Disarmament treaty of President Richardson's is more of his political showboating. We are back to square one. Unless we can develop a new weapon system fast.
Oh, Christ.
The letter falls
again?
To the floor.
Why can't you people ever leave it be?
Are the Russians gonna leave it be?
As Rogers enters, Meyer rushes past him and stalks from the room.
What's with him?
The colonel shrugs. Sitting down in Meyer's chair, he picks the letter from the floor and tosses it onto the desk. Then he picks it up and reads it.
We got trouble. He's figured it out. Take a look.
My God. He's gonna blow the whistle to Senator Barclay's Defense Oversight Committee. What do you propose to do?
I think you should send him over to Letterman this afternoon for a routine physical.
No, I'm not crazy!
Three orderlies drag Dr. Meyer along a hospital corridor.
No! I'm not crazy!
Horsemen race across the steps in Cossack, Soviet Socialist Republic. A boy rides toward them. Reining in his horse, he waves at the horsemen to follow him. A flock of sheep moves aside as the boy leads the galloping horsemen up a rise in the land. Dead sheep litter the ground near the edge of a steep river valley. The boy dismounts and waves the men to him. On television,
the Italian flu epidemic has spread worldwide. Reports of staggering death tolls are rolling in from all parts of the globe. Vaccines are in short supply everywhere.
In the White House, officials watch the newscast.
Martial law is the order of the day. Disruption of communications and shipping has left much of the world isolated in fear, with inadequate food and medical supplies. A United Kingdom report indicates widespread damage to private and public property. Our Spanish correspondent, Mel Nyman, was killed earlier today while covering the riots in Madrid. Civil disorder in France and
West Germany. A scene of fiery protest dominates the screen.
Japan has been the scene of countrywide chaos for over a week. The police report that it will take at least another week to regain law and order and resume distribution of food and medical supplies. Stateside, we are no exception. Mass demonstrations on Capitol Hill have become daily events. This morning, the National Guard reported 57 killed. The demands of an angry crowd for effective vaccines and government action have only been met with military confrontation. President Richardson's televised appeal for calm and restraint has had no effect. It is impossible to predict the restoration of order. Washington's unrest is reflected in
That's
the
enough.
Rest of the country. In California, the
President
Air
Richardson turns in his chair to face the men gathered around the table.
What vaccine?
He slaps the table and stands.
All right. How long will it take to manufacture this vaccine in quantity?
One man rises.
Mr. President, we have not even been able to isolate the cause. The virus, if it is a virus, is like the common cold. It is everywhere. It is nowhere.
I'd like to say at this point, Mr. President, that HHS might have been in a better position to develop a crash program if its budget hadn't been slashed against the specific wishes of Congress.
Damn it, Senator, I don't have to hear that from you.
What do you mean? There is no vaccine? Then what is it that we're giving the police and fire department personnel, the essential services, the military alert crews, if not a vaccine? It's just that we don't have enough for the general populace. Isn't that right?
We have a vaccine of sorts. We've put together a soup of every flu-related vaccine we know. Its effect leaves something to be desired. In fact, it's more of a placebo than anything else.
You gave me a goddamn placebo?
We are doing our best.
Mr. President.
A general enters.
My apologies for being late, but I have been gathering the latest intelligence estimates of of our situation.
The colonel unrolls a map.
This shows where this Italian flu first broke out.
They turn to the next map.
Here we have a breakdown of victims. Alive, yellow. Dead, black. According to region. As of this morning, Mr. President, I would like to point out the very real possibility that we might not have just an epidemic in our hands. We may have a case of germ warfare.
From where? What source? Every country on this chart has massive casualties. Can you explain that?
As far as we know, some of our information is quite sketchy. Still, the most suspect country should be obvious.
Colonel Rankin watches the president closely.
Do you have any hard evidence to support this theory?
We are working on it. In the meantime, Mr. President, as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I must request that we go onto a stage one alert, including the activation of the ARS network.
A nuclear strike, General. All right, stage one alert, if that makes you feel any better, but the automatic reaction system is aimed at the Soviet Union, and no one else leaves us no flexibility at all.
How flexible are we going to be when Soviet missiles are incoming?
Well, the only thing that's incoming are the germs, General.
An aide hurries to a desk, opens a drawer, and removes a red telephone.
Yes, one moment. Mr. President, the Kremlin.
His jaw clenched tight. The president takes the phone.
This is President Richardson. What? Yes, yes, I understand.
Grimly, the president leans on his desk and looks around the room.
Well, the message was brief enough. Their chief of state died this morning of the Italian flu.
General Garland looks at the others.
As far as we know,
I am Star Fool.
In Milan, Italy, emergency medical units race down an inner city street. A woman with a baby in her arms desperately chases after an ambulance. Paramedics swing the rear door of an ambulance open, remove a gurney, and hurry through a crowd toward a hospital. A large crowd of women with babies in their arms push and shove in a frenzied crush outside the hospital. They wave their arms, pleading for help. Newspapers from around the globe headline the Italian flu and feature tragic photos of its victims. An ambulance pulls into a Japanese hospital. A crowd moves aside from the second ambulance as nurses and doctors carry stretchers into an overcrowded emergency room. A mother with a baby in her arms appeals to a doctor. She was coughing and then she became listless. Get her admitted immediately, the doctor responds. Pneumonia and heart failure. The mother clutches the doctor's arm. Both my husband and myself are very sick, doctor. And all the hospitals are full. The doctor replies, I know, we'll take care of her. The doctor gently pushes people aside, then suddenly collapses. A nurse and a colleague hurry to his side and help him to his feet. The colleague says, doctor, I'll fill in for you. The doctor replies, do you mind? Thanks. Meanwhile, at the White House.
Damn it. There must be something we can do about it. Something!
A Marine shows the senator in.
Mr. President, has the plague been identified yet?
Senator Barclay carries a file folder in one hand. Yeah. Richardson turns his back to him.
Senator, we don't know whether we're dealing with one plague germ or six. We don't even know where it came from or how it is being transmitted.
Barclay looks up from the file.
Well, maybe we've been looking in the wrong direction.
He stares ominously at General Garland.
We have looked in every direction, Senator.
Tell us something about Operation Phoenix, General Garland.
Phoenix?
Richardson steps toward the men.
What is Operation Phoenix?
Just a paper study.
Oh?
One of several options being studied in purely theoretical terms.
Mr. President. Nothing more.
Maybe a little bit more, General.
What are we talking about?
Operation Phoenix was a top secret military study of a new weapon system.
There are many such studies. It goes with the job. New weapons, new studies, new alternatives.
A biological weapon system.
It was a paper study.
It was an active research project involving the genetic manipulation of existing pathogenic viruses.
It was theoretical.
New strains were not just studied, they were created in the laboratory.
Under completely controlled conditions, I assure you, Mr. President.
One strain, MM88, was stolen and never recovered, and the President was never told about it. Now I'd like to know why.
The General tosses his papers onto the table, stands up, and steps to a phone.
Colonel Rankin, get in here this minute.
Colonel Rankin enters, coughing into a handkerchief.
Colonel Rankin, Operation Phoenix was your baby. MM88. Was such a strain developed?
Yes, sir.
Was any of it stolen?
No, sir, but it wouldn't have made any difference anyway.
Why not?
MM88 was a failure. It was benign.
He's lying.
Senator, I have had enough accusation for one afternoon. Now, I demand to know the source of this horrible slander.
Barclay motions to an aide who steps to a set of French doors and opens them. Dr. Myers steps through. Rankin is taken aback.
Sir, this man is a paranoid schizophrenic. I can vouch for that.
This is Dr. Baldwin's report. Dr. Meyer is incurably sane, but it took us a little while to find that out because Colonel Rankin had put him away.
Colonel, why was he committed?
Keep him from passing information about Operation Phoenix to my subcommittee.
President Richardson slowly stands and steps toward Meyer.
Tell me something. Is this Italian flu actually MM88?
I'm sure of it, sir.
Sir, I fully support you in this last-ditch effort. But I must stress the importance of a strong military posture at this moment. Again, I urge a stage one alert, including the ARS activation.
General, get out of my sight.
Mr. President.
I said, get out of my sight.
General Garland glares at Richardson, then turns and walks bitterly away.
Gentlemen, we will place a lid of complete secrecy on this situation.
Richardson turns to Dr. Meyer.
Now, what do you need? Yes. I understand.
The president stands slumped over his desk. His back to the men in the room.
My wife has come down with a cold.
Tears in his eyes, Richardson slowly turns to face the others.
What do you need, Doctor? What do you need?
Japan, under martial law. A convoy of troops enters a square ringed by soldiers with fixed bayonets. In a trash-strewn inner-city street, jeeps roll to a halt. Soldiers leap from their vehicles and run to join others loading dead civilians from stretchers onto the bed of an army truck. By night, piles of corpses litter a street in flames. Masked soldiers wielding flamethrowers immolate the mountains of flu victims. Other soldiers toss the dead from trucks onto the growing mounds of corpses. Towering sheets of flame leap high over the piles of burning bodies. In the White House, President Richardson and Senator Barkley sit uncomfortably in the trash-strewn Oval Office, blankets wrapped around their shoulders. Standing, Richardson snugs his blanket tighter, then steps slowly to the window.
This may be the last sunset we'll ever see.
He sits on the edge of his desk.
If we only had a little more time.
Eyes closed, Barkley chuckles.
Those were Dr. Meyer's last words.
God, how about the entire civilization sputtered out with those words? As our speechwriters are so fond of having a say about history, those who can't remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
I wanted my name to be entered into the history books, but I wanted it to be for something meaningful, something lasting. What could I have done that would have made the slightest damn bit of difference? What could I have done?
Maybe it will snow. Might give us a little more time.
How?
Meyer said that the virus remains dormant. Cold temperatures.
Well, it's not going to snow, Senator. Besides, it has to get damn cold.
Thoughtfully, Richardson turns to Barkley. The senator meets his gaze.
Antarctica.
Palmer Station.
Abruptly, the president stands and steps to his desk telephone.
Oh, come on, there must be some.
Yes, Mr. President.
Get me Palmer Station.
Ice floes dot the surface of the frigid Antarctic waters. Snow-capped mountains loom behind the two buildings nestled on the shore.
Palmer Station, this is the President of the United States.
This is Admiral Conway here, Mr. President.
I would like the entire American continent to hear what I have to say. Has the sickness hit your station yet?
No, sir. There is no sign of any illness here.
And the other stations?
There are no reported illnesses at any of the stations, and we are in more or less regular contact. How bad is it, Mr. President?
Patch me through to the other Antarctic bases.
All of them, sir?
All of them, Admiral Conway.
Right away, Mr. President.
Attention! Attention!
At Mirny Station, USSR, men gather around the base radio.
The President of the United States.
At Chile's Fry Station, men run to the radio shed.
It is with great regret and personal sorrow.
The men at Japan's Showa Station hurry into the radio room.
Position of the government of the United States that I officially confirm what most of you already know. The world has been beset by a horrible plague.
The men at France's Derville Station hang on every word.
An effective vaccine. We do know something about this virus. We know this virus remains dormant under sub-zero conditions.
The Americans huddle close to the speaker.
For this reason, you in Antarctica have not been affected.
Do not leave your sanctuary.
The Russians listen somberly.
Do not allow those from the outside to enter. Under no conditions, try to return.
I offer you no solutions. No hope, other than that somehow you may prevail. This time, try to work it out together, please. And may God bless you all.
Richardson struggles to contain himself, then hangs up the phone.
I've been snowed in all this time. You and the research crew could be flown down. You'd be safe there.
We'll make it. God willing.
Not we, Mr. President. You. You represent the nation. The government must continue.
His face beaded with sweat, Richardson watches as Barclay slumps back in his chair and dies. A rueful smile crosses the president's face.
You were my opponent in every political battle, but you were never my enemy.
The streets of New York City are still and lifeless. The number of victims there has risen to 7,400,000 dead. The city of London, England, is deathly calm. 6,900,000 of its citizens have died. In Paris, France, nothing stirs in the streets. The public squares and cathedrals are empty. 2,300,000 Parisians have perished. In the Vatican and Rome, the only human figures in the streets are those of statues. The body count is 2,900,000. In Moscow, the death toll has climbed to 7,800,000. The sun sets over Tokyo, where 10 million have been lost. Flushed and sweating, President Richardson sits at his desk. He grabs his chest, then drops his head onto his arm, hammers the desktop, and dies. General Garland strides briskly into the room.
Mr. President, I formally request that you, under this authority granted by Congress and by the Constitution of the United States of America, meeting your responsibility to defend this great land against all enemies, internal and external, give the order to put our retaliatory forces on full alert. Stage one, including the activation of the ARS.
Standing at attention, Garland snaps off a salute, pivots on his heel, and marches out of the Oval Office. An elevator descends in its shaft. Suspended from its cables, the elevator travels down the shaft as the counterweight travels up. As the doors open, Garland steps out and walks up to a steel security door.
General Garland, CX-34.
The doors slide open. Garland walks through, and the doors close behind him. Entering an underground control room, Garland walks between two dead bodies lying on the floor. He mounts a short flight of stairs and stands before the bunker's control panel. As he turns on a series of switches, a map of the world illuminates the wall in front of him. Garland sits down and presses another series of switches. A panel slides open to reveal the ARS controls. He turns a knob labeled Safe. Red lights illuminate the Western Hemisphere. He turns the knob labeled Armed, and red lights blink across the Soviet Union. Garland swivels his chair to face a bank of television monitors. One of the screens shows a missile in its silo. Another screen shows the missile from the bottom of the silo. Another shows the missile sliding up the silo, rising toward the launching pad. Gleaming in the sunlight, the missile sits on its pad. Two men ski down an Antarctic Palmer mountainside.
Station. This is Showa Station. Over.
Palmer Station by.
Our two representatives to the Antarctic Council meeting had transport problems. At last contact, they were proceeding to the nearest station for help.
Over. Roger, Showa. We'll be standing by if you need assistance.
The skiers stop on a ridge above Norway Station. Carrying their skis, they run through the snow up to the front of the building. Planting their skis in a snowbank, they step over a railing onto the front porch.
Hello! Is anyone there? Hello! Is anyone?
Through the window, they see frozen bodies, bullet holes through their necks and skulls. Shocked, the skiers glance at each other, then step back. One man lunges at the door with his shoulder. With the other man's help, he breaks the door open. Inside, they sweep the interior of the darkened station with their flashlights. Startled, one man steps back as a beam of light illuminates a corpse lying on a foosball table. They look nervously around the room. Cautiously, they cross the floor to the back door. Moving outside, they step gingerly past a snowbank, stopping to shine their lights on a crumpled, frozen corpse. They turn to go back inside, but stop at a sudden sound. Glancing behind them, they shine their lights onto the door of a shed. In the glare of their flashlight beams, the doorknob turns slowly. They direct their lights away from the door. As they watch, it slowly creeps open. A woman peers through the opening, her eyes fearful. The men gaze at her, surprised.
What's happened here?
The door opens wider. The woman collapses to the ground, wearing only a nightdress and a blanket. She's pregnant. Later, they sit at her bedside.
We were just sitting there. Not talking. The radio man shot himself. Then everyone went mad. My husband pulled out a gun and pointed it at me.
She turns her eyes to a photo of her husband with his arm around her.
I ran, but he just came after me. I closed and locked the door. And he just kept banging. And then someone shot him.
She closes her eyes. Later, outside the station, the two men stack rocks to construct a cairn over the dead. They remove their gloves and toques. One man kneels in the snow. Before the cairn, they press their hands together and pray. One man says, Yoshizumi, it'd be best if you stayed here. I have to be there at the meeting. But taking her with us would be out of the question. I know this will be a tough job. It's okay. I'll handle it somehow. His friend says, a birth at a time like this. Hope it works out. Later, at Palmer Station.
We are almost certainly all that is left, the sole survivors. 855 men and 8 women. We have supplies to last us for 2 years at the present levels of consumption. But we must work together, pooling our scientific knowledge so we can survive until the virus dies out. And that is the purpose of this meeting, to devise a plan to enable us to deal with our present situation.
We are not completely isolated here, now are we, Admiral? Not after the thaw.
What do you mean, Dr. Tarovich?
You have an icebreaker that was not able to make it out before the last freeze. It's been here all winter. So, we could, in fact, go back, if we so elected.
To what purpose go back, Dr. Tarovich?
To what purpose stay, Admiral Conway? There are some who might choose to go back and make the best of it, instead of spending the rest of our lives here, marooned.
There is no best of it to make, Dr. Tarovich. The question before us is how best to organize the resources at our disposal.
I do not have to listen to you anymore, Borodino. You have no tanks here.
Gentlemen, we must not allow this to degenerate to personal levels. Dr. Borodinov is absolutely correct. We must establish our priorities.
Admiral Conway, representative of the Soviet Union whose rank is not clear.
Not now, Lopez.
Exactly what I would expect from Argentina.
Mocking Lopez, the Argentine dismisses him with a wave of his hand. Lunging, Lopez grabs the Argentine's collar and punches him. The meeting erupts in a brawl. The Admiral shouts for order. Lopez wrestles the Argentine to the floor. An American officer fires his pistol at the ceiling. More men hurry into the room. The officer walks slowly across the room, pointing his pistol at the crowd.
If you people want to hurt each other, I suggest you use this.
He holds the pistol up in front of them, then places it on the table in front of the Argentine.
It's a lot more effective.
He glances at Lopez and the Argentine, then turns and walks out of the room. The two main combatants exchange hostile glances. Then the Argentine straightens his uniform. Lopez reaches down to help a man to his feet.
You Americans have a certain directness.
As though we needed another method of killing ourselves.
Admiral? Sorry, sir. We just picked up a submarine distress signal. Sir, they're on their way here. They wish permission to disembark.
Palmer Station?
No, sir, to the Soviet station. We intercepted the message. It's the Soviet sub T-232. They are requesting emergency assistance, sir.
On the open sea, a submarine rides the waves on the surface. A Soviet flag flies from the conning tower.
Ensign Smirnov speaking. Acting captain of Soviet submarine T-232.
Ensign Smirnov, this is Admiral Conway, chairman of the Federal Council of Antarctica. We understand that some of your men are injured.
No injuries, Admiral. We have illness. My men need provisions and medical attention.
What is the nature of the illness?
Smirnov grimly surveys the crew.
Italian flu.
The Admiral shakes his head sadly.
In that case, it is my duty to inform you with great reluctance that the Federal Council of Antarctica refuses you permission to land.
What are you telling me?
Dr. Borodinov leans into the microphone.
Ensign Smirnov, this is Dr. Borodinov, commander of the Soviet Antarctic Wintering Team.
Ensign Smirnov, doctor, requesting permission to land.
Smirnov, it is not possible that you should land. You would infect us all. You must understand.
Dr. Borodinov, my men must leave this boat. We need rest. We need medical attention. Can you hear me? Doctor! Can you hear me? We will land.
You will not land.
The new transmission takes Admiral Conway and Smirnov by surprise.
Who is this speaking?
Her Majesty's nuclear attack submarine, Nereid. Captain McLeod at your service.
This is not your concern, English!
We have the most profound sympathy for your situation, Ensign Smirnov. But surely you realize you cannot be allowed to disembark.
I have a responsibility to my men.
You have a higher responsibility.
Smirnov turns to his crew.
Zasechi!
They don their headsets and monitor their sonar screens. A periscope scans the ice floes in the coastline. Smirnov peers into the periscope.
Много айсберга. Тяжело засечь.
Smirnov returns to the radio.
There is nothing more to say, Captain McCloud.
Captain McCloud, what is your present position?
Sufficiently close, I should say.
Then, Captain, do what you have to do.
Smirnov turns to his men.
Pavistan!
The men scramble to their battle stations. One sailor slows to embrace an unconscious comrade. Others dart up into the conning tower. A blip appears on the Russian sonar screen. The British sub moves out from behind an iceberg. Downing periscope, the Russian sub dives beneath the surface of the icy waters. In the British sub, Captain McCloud downs periscope.
Log number 42 with Subrock.
Fully submerged, the Soviet sub dives steeply.
Target range, 6,000 yards.
Check, range, 6,000 yards.
A missile streaks from the British sub and breaks through the surface. Flying low, it re-enters the water, strikes the Soviet sub. A great gush of water billows into the air. Inside Palmer Station, heads are bowed.
The tight little island remains secure for now. Admiral Conway, farewell.
Captain McCloud, we owe you our thanks. Where will you go?
We'll just sail on.
Captain McCloud.
Yes, sir.
How long have you been on station?
Since February.
That's winter back there. Captain, I want you to answer this next question very carefully. Are you or any of your men infected?
No, sir, we're not.
The Admiral looks inquiringly at the Federation counselors to his right. Silently, they nod their assent. He looks to those on his left. And then turns to Dr. Barodinov.
It must be unanimous.
Slowly turning his head to the Admiral, Dr. Barodinov sadly nods his approval, then looks away, his eyes moist.
Captain McCloud, would you care to come aboard, sir?
Solemnly, McCloud looks over his shoulder at the crewmen gathered around him.
Yes, sir. I believe we would.
Good. We look forward to it.
Stand by to surface.
Stand by to surface.
Stand by to surface.
The British sub's conning tower and bow surface near the rocky Antarctic coast. In Palmer Station, a secretary approaches the table carrying a note.
Mr. Nakanishi?
Yes.
Nakanishi skims the note.
May I have your attention, please? I have just received a notification from my colleague, Dr. Norwegian, survivor, has just given birth to a baby girl.
Dr. Turowich shakes his head.
Rather unfortunate being born into this situation.
Not necessarily, Doctor. That will be up to us.
If there was still a world out there, father by now.
A haggard Captain Lopez hangs his head, then looks up at Nakanishi.
Has she chosen a name for the child? Green.
sound.
Gry in Norwegian is a word meaning the first light of the sun, the dawn of a new day.
Baby Gry sleeps peacefully in a bed next to her mother.
Yes?
Yoshizumi enters the room, a sheet of paper in hand.
Here's a message.
A message? From whom?
From the Federal Council of Antarctica.
I've never heard of them.
Neither did anyone else before today. We are here. We must have a government. One of their first official actions was to issue a proclamation. Welcoming Gry to the new world. And wishing her every happiness.
Every happiness.
Also, they want to know if the council can serve as a collective godfather.
The mother smiles slightly.
How nice of them.
Gry's mother glances down at her. Later, at Palmer Station.
It's too much! How can we live like that?
Sylvia, from the bottom of my heart, I wish that I could answer your question.
Rape is rape! The fact is, Sylvia was attacked, and it cannot be allowed to happen again!
My dear, I'm sure no one wishes to minimize the seriousness of what happened. However, we are dealing with a human animal's natural reaction to the threat of extinction, which is to reproduce, to propagate the species. It is regrettable, but inevitable.
This is not the point. If this council cannot take care of their 8 women, well then, gentlemen, this whole thing is just a joke.
Of course, there's truth in what you say. We must protect our women.
Oh, let's face it. What we really need is a completely new attitude toward human sexuality. In a community of 855 men and 8 women, conventional one-to-one relationships between men and women will not be possible.
Well, that may be so. But I agree with Dr. Latour that we should be concerned with the instinct for survival and think of brothers and sisters for little Gry.
Indeed. The question now must be, how do we go about it? Dr. Olich?
Well, we really don't know how to go about it just yet. Although the problem itself is certainly clear enough. Women have become our most valuable natural resource. And as has just been pointed out, one-to-one relationships are no longer possible. This means that each woman, however reluctantly, will have to accommodate more than one man. Of course, we will have to go against deep personal feelings. And this is an extremely serious matter. But somehow we must find the will to suppress our instincts. And that is what troubles me the most. Can we? Can we control our instincts with reason?
Unless we can, there is no future.
The British sub cruises offshore.
This is the Nereid to all Antarctic stations. We are embarking on our first official Federal Council mission to assess the status of the virus and search for other pockets of life. Stations will be contacted individually with respective national reports.
From the conning tower, Captain McLeod scans the surface through binoculars as the Nereid sails out of port in calm seas. The sky over Tokyo is deep orange.
This is JGX, Antarctica.
The wind tosses trash along the lonely street in front of a derelict office building. Inside, moldering corpses litter the floor. At Showa Station...
Does anyone read my transmission? What the conditions in Japan? Answer me, someone. Please, answer me. Over.
Colleagues crowd around Tatsuno. He pounds the desktop. Swiveling in his chair, he drinks thirstily from a kettle. Still no answer, one of the other men says. We've had no contact for 20 days now. Must have hit him hard. How could the entire Japanese population die in 3 months? It cannot be. I won't believe it.
Calling 8JIRL, show attention.
The men crowd to the receiver. Who's calling? Asks Tetsuno.
This is 8JIRL.
This is the Nereid. We are presently entering Tokyo Bay, our final stop in Japan. Please stand by for the surveillance report.
The Nereid's periscope cuts along the surface of the water in Tokyo Bay.
Very good. Stop together.
Stop together.
Launch surveillance drone.
Surveillance drone now being launched.
A stubby, missile-like object, the drone shoots up over the bay. Rotors spinning, it hangs in the sky like a miniature helicopter. Captain McLeod watches through the periscope as the drone hovers over downtown Tokyo.
The drone is over Tokyo. We are receiving video transmission now.
As the Japanese listen intently to their radio, McLeod downs periscope. A crewman wheels a video monitor over to him.
Life sign survey within range of equipment. Now in progress.
The camera in the drone sweeps the city. Images click onto the monitor. Nothing moves.
We have not been able to detect any signs of human life in Tokyo.
At Showa Station, Tatsuno weeps.
In concluding our video survey, we have not witnessed any evidence of human life in Japan.
Tatsuno collapses on the desktop.
Air sample analysis. About to commence. Please stand by.
Cheer up, says Yoshizumi. Damage kisses Tatsuno as he leaps to his feet, knocking men over, and charges out of the radio room into the corridor. Pulling on a parka, Yoshizumi runs after him. He throws the door open to a raging blizzard. Flashlight in hand, he fights his way into the snowy night. Buffeted by the wind and snow, he searches for Tatsuno. Yoshizumi stumbles, falls to the ground, and struggles to regain his feet. A man runs toward him. Other men from the station run to catch up and grab Yoshizumi. One says it's too dangerous to keep this up. Not in this blizzard. They wrestle him to the ground. Look, I know where he went. He's gone off to join his family. I wish I could do the same. On his knees, Yoshizumi struggles to break free of his friends. Beneath the surface of Tokyo Bay...
56 feet.
Keep 56 feet.
Stand by to take on air sample.
A pneumatic coupling engages. Deep in the bowels of the sub, surface air is drawn through an elaborate construction of glass tubing. Under the control of Dr. Latour, a robotic arm swings around to remove a tiny glass container from a porcelain vial. The doctor maneuvers the arm to carefully drop the container into a sturdy metal vessel.
Captain, the analysis of the air sample from the outside environment is complete.
Result?
Positive. The virus is still quite active.
Retrieve the drone, eject the air sample.
Captain! I ask of you, do not eject the sample.
That's impossible, Dr. Latour. You want us to keep that thing with us? Take it back? It's quite out of the question.
I beg of you, reconsider, Captain. You're thinking only of the short-term risk, Captain. This submarine, it is powered by a nuclear reactor. Is there no danger to us from the radioactivity of the core?
Of course not. We're completely shielded from.
I accept your expertise in this matter. Will you not accept mine? Captain, what choice do we have but at least to try?
Retrieve the drone. Secure air sample in isolation.
Retrieve drone, secure air sample in isolation.
McCloud lowers the periscope.
Let's head for home.
One crewman turns to another.
Head for home. Be different if we had a home to return to now, wouldn't it? Head for Antarctica, it should be. 9,000 miles is the crow flies.
Except there aren't no crows.
Christmas in Antarctica. Snow frames a Catholic shrine to Mary, and votive candles burn before a Russian Orthodox shrine to the Holy Virgin. Dr. Latour sits in his lab, working at his desk. Springing to his feet, he strides to the window of an isolation chamber. Punching a set of buttons, he directs the robotic arm toward a vault in the center of the chamber. The glass container with the Tokyo air sample sits in the center of the vault. As a brilliant white light illuminates the container, Dr. Latour gazes at it intently. At Palmer Station, the survivors have gathered for a Christmas party. Captain Lopez joyfully licks Gree up over his head. Admiral Conway stands as another baby is passed to him.
Let's see what we can do with this big fellow. Oh, my goodness.
Around the room, other men hold other babies.
You want the mommy? Okay.
Yoshizumi backs across the crowded room, looking for someone.
She's beautiful.
Gree's mother glances up to find Yoshizumi watching them. He smiles at her from the doorway, triggering a memory of his wife speaking to him. I'm going to have a baby, she tells him. Yoshizumi looks up at her. It'll be born while you're in the Antarctic, she says, and looks at him sadly. The memory over, Yoshizumi turns his back on the room.
Excuse me.
Gree's mother rises and walks toward the doorway. As she moves across the room, she unfastens her necklace. She stops behind Yoshizumi.
Merry Christmas.
He turns to her, then smiles.
Merry Christmas.
From Gree.
From Gree?
He takes the necklace from her hand.
Please thank her for me.
Thank her yourself. What's the matter? Don't you like children?
There was a time, perhaps, when I did not.
I don't understand.
Sometimes I cannot express myself very well.
Merritt?
Yes?
A young American sailor steps toward her.
I believe we have an appointment.
He opens a Christmas card. Merritt's name is written inside. She lifts her eyes from the card to the young man's face. Yoshizumi glances at the card, at Merritt, and at the eager young sailor. Merritt turns to find Yoshizumi across the room, walking out the door. Later, in her room, Merritt doesn't even hear the words of the eager young sailor as she pulls the curtain across the window. Gazing outside, she finds Yoshizumi, shovel in hand, carving a snow sculpture. Merritt struggles with her emotions, then pulls the curtain tight. Later, Yoshizumi sleeps slumped in his desk chair beneath a blazing goosenecked lamp. His roommate, the American officer, pulls himself up onto the top bunk to lie on his back, staring at the ceiling. He reaches down and switches off the lamp, pauses, then switches it back on to stare down at Yoshizumi's desk. Reaching down, he lifts the edge of a hand-drawn map showing fault lines in the northeastern United States. Concentric circles have been drawn around Washington, D.C. The next day...
You sent for me, Admiral Conway?
Yes, Dr. Yoshizumi. Would you come in, please? It appears we may have a small problem here. Would you mind explaining what this seismic map means, in layman's terms?
Yoshizumi moves to the map.
Well, out here is the Baltimore Canyon.
where offshore oil drilling had recently started. In my field of earthquake prediction, I became extremely interested in this situation.
But that is not an earthquake-prone area.
You're right, Captain Lopez. But I was concerned about what might happen when the trapped oil in this area was brought out. The tremendous weight of the sea pressing down, it could lead to a tectonic movement of great magnitude.
What is the expected magnitude of this earth tremor if it occurs?
Between 8.6 and 9 on the Richter scale.
You place the epicenter here?
Yes, within a 100-mile radius of that point.
That means that Washington, D.C. could be severely affected?
Yes.
Doctor, let me ask you, could this shock be as great as a nuclear explosion?
Well, the rapid vertical movement of the shock pattern would be like the shock wave of a nuclear explosion, yes.
One by one, Yoshizumi looks at each of the men in the room.
I should emphasize, however, that this earthquake will occur in the eastern seaboard area, not here.
When would you expect this earthquake to hit?
Within a month.
Admiral Conway shakes his head, then turns to the American officer.
Major Carter, I think it's time you told everybody what you already told me. Gentlemen, by way of explanation, Major Carter is a former staff member with the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he acted as liaison to the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
The United States has in place a retaliatory missile system called the ARS, Automatic Reaction System. An earthquake of the magnitude indicated by Dr. Yoshizumi would trigger the ARS. Now, the United States military was very closely coordinated with that of the United Kingdom. Captain McLeod, sir?
Major Carter is quite correct, gentlemen. About a year ago, in September, while on station, we on the Nereid did indeed receive the activation signal. It's rather surprising, I might add, because we assumed there was no one left alive in Washington to send it.
I think it's imperative that you gentlemen hear some cold facts from my Soviet colleague.
Major Carter steps over to a man sitting at a desk.
Captain Nevsky?
The Soviet officer stands.
The first missile to hit Russian soil will set off our entire retaliatory force. Our system was activated over a year ago. But that's not all, I'm afraid.
What do you mean?
The opinion was held at one time that the United States was planning the construction of a secret base here at Palmer Station. I believe that Palmer Station is targeted.
What?
That is insane!
The United States had no particular monopoly on idiots.
But this is impossible!
There is one thing we could do. Send someone to Washington to disarm the damn thing.
But what about the virus?
If you're right about the earthquake, what choice have we?
Later, in a room crowded with silent, apprehensive men, the Argentine officer staples closed playing cards which have been folded in half and throws them into a hat. Admiral Conway rises and walks toward the front ranks of men. He holds the ace of spades up for them to see, then passes it to the Argentine, who folds it in half, staples it closed, and drops it into the hat. The admiral mixes up the cards, then steps back. The Argentine holds the hat high at arm's length. One by one, the men approach to pick a card from the hat. As the Admiral walks gravely away from the ritual, Major Carter sits in his chair, his forehead furrowed. He turns abruptly to watch the men draw their cards. Each, in turn, pops the staple and holds his card up for inspection. Jumping to his feet, Carter steps over to the Admiral.
Admiral, this is stupid.
Yes! This is stupid!
Carter walks over to the Argentine, takes the hat from his hand, and tips the cards out onto the floor.
Admiral, I'm going myself.
Carter pushes through the crowd of men and heads for the door. Yoshizumi slips through the crowd to kneel on the floor. Picking up the scattered cards, he returns them to the hat.
It's all right, Doctor. Major Carter is correct. It must be him.
He will need help.
Yoshizumi stuffs the rest of the cards into the hat. Outside, in the glaring sunlight, Carter walks through the snow at the foot of the mountains. As he approaches the shoreline, Yoshizumi appears, running to catch up to him.
Major Carter!
He steps in front of Carter, then brandishes the Ace of Spades. Carter takes the card from him, tears it up, and drops it in the snow.
You're not going, Pat.
You cannot do this alone.
If I was going to take someone with me, which I'm not, it sure as hell wouldn't be you.
Why?
Look, Doctor, have you ever handled explosives?
Yes, many times. In seismic experiments.
Well, even if you had handled explosives, you'd slow me down.
No.
I don't want to hurt your feelings, Doctor, but you're not physically tough enough for the job. I'm sorry.
Carter pats him on the shoulder and walks away. Running after him, Yoshizumi throws a weak punch that bounces off Carter's shoulder.
No.
Carter walks away. Yoshizumi runs after him and grabs him around the neck. Carter flips him over his shoulder and holds him still in the snow.
You're gonna go on back home now, you understand? Now get up!
He hauls the smaller man to his feet. Yoshizumi punches Carter in the mouth. The major wipes blood from his lip.
I suggest you get out of my way and get on home.
No.
Carter kicks the legs out from under Yoshizumi, then walks on. Yoshizumi scrambles after Carter and wraps his arms around his knees. Carter flings him onto his back and continues on his way. Yoshizumi rolls to his feet, clambers after the officer, and launches himself at his legs.
Ow! God damn it!
Carter lifts him by the hair and knocks him flying with one punch.
Jesus Christ! He bit me!
Carter walks on. Holding his face with one hand, Yoshizumi raises himself to his knees, struggles to his feet, and staggers after Carter. As Carter turns, Yoshizumi stumbles to his knees, rises, and falls at Carter's feet. Reaching up to grab the major's parka, he pulls himself to his feet, then starts swinging. Carter blocks the punches with ease. The smaller man hangs on. Raising his eyes to the heavens in frustration, Carter sends Yoshizumi sprawling with one punch. He gazes down on the fallen man.
Life is wonderful. Hey, Yoshizumi, how do you say life is wonderful in Japanese?
Mouth bloodied, Yoshizumi lies unconscious in the snow. Carter bends over the fallen scientist. Reaching down, he pulls him into a sitting position, then slings him over his shoulder. Straightening up, he heads back to the station with his burden. Later, inside the station.
Gentlemen,
A toast is in order.
Glasses in hand, the men gather round the Admiral's table.
You leave early tomorrow morning. To your success.
Success.
The men raise their glasses and drink. Then resume their seats. Reflectively, Captain Lopez remains on his feet.
How quickly the last few days have gone.
If only we could turn back the clock.
Borodinov glances at Nakanishi.
How many days would it take to reach Washington?
10 days, I should say.
8 women and children and a skeleton crew will get underway in the icebreaker first thing in the morning. If worst comes to worst, they should still be out of range when the missiles hit. Assuming the missiles are accurate enough to hit the base.
Captain Nevsky stands up.
There is no question of our missiles not hitting the target.
That's very reassuring.
And what about the rest of you?
The rest of us will hope for the best.
Sure.
As Lopez steps away, the Admiral reaches under the table.
Major Carter, I have been saving this for a very special occasion.
It's a bottle of cognac.
I really shouldn't take it, sir. I drink it by myself, but I will.
If Carter's going to get drunk tonight, you don't want to be in the same room with him.
He offers Yoshizumi the keys to his room.
Oh, please.
Yoshizumi accepts the keys.
Thank you.
The men turn to find Lopez seated at the piano.
Qué grande que viene el río, qué grande se va la mar. Qué grande que viene el río, qué grande se va la mar.
Yoshizumi lets himself into the Admiral's room. Dropping his parka on a table, he looks over the Admiral's library. He drops the key on the desk, then notices a book sitting on the desktop. Opening the cover, he reads the title page, The Way of Zen. Turning the page, he scans the foreword with interest. Picking the book up, Yoshizumi crosses the room as he reads. He slides open the curtain to the sleeping area. Merritt sits on the bed, gazing at him. Yoshizumi drops his eyes uncomfortably, then meets her gaze. Merritt's sad brown eyes don't waver. She rises slowly, then steps toward him. Closing the book, she gently takes it from his hands and places it on the bed. Reaching for him, she embraces him fiercely and draws him down to the bed. They kiss passionately. The next morning, the frigid Antarctic waters reflect the blue of a cloudless sky. The British submarine sits moored in a narrow fjord. A dinghy motors toward the sub, where the crew of the Nereid stands at parade on the deck. Alongside, its passengers toss their kit bags aboard the sub. Carter climbs up to the deck after them, then turns to give Yoshizumi a hand as he climbs aboard. Captain McLeod and Major Carter exchange salutes. McLeod leads Carter and Yoshizumi along the deck. to the access hatch in the base of the conning tower. Below, the two men unpack their gear.
Bonjour.
Doctor.
I trust you will forgive this last-minute intrusion. Without going into boring detail, I believe, mind you, that I have developed a vaccine against the virus.
The two men turn to Latour.
But how?
Well, to simplify, it appears that high levels of radiation introduced into a living virus cell create an effective antibody. Of course, I cannot force anyone to become a guinea pig. But under the circumstances...
What the hell?
Carter takes a swig from the bottle of cognac.
The effect should be immediate. To minimize the danger to the crew, do not inject yourselves until just before you leave the submarine. If it does not work, please report your symptoms.
Dr. Latour offers the antidote kit to them.
As long as you can.
Yoshizumi takes a vial from the kit.
We will do our best.
Out on the water, three inflatable dinghies ferry the women and children to the icebreaker. Alongside, they pull to a stop at the foot of a gangway. With Gree bundled in her arms, Merritt lets the deckhands help her up the gangway. The other women and their infants follow her on deck. Their babies in their arms, the eight women gather at the rail to watch the Nereid leaving Palmer Station. Merritt looks intently at the sub, her fears for Yoshizumi in her eyes. The women and the sailors watch solemnly. Rugged mountains ringing the shoreline of Antarctica, the Nereid begins its voyage to Washington. Seals bark as the submarine glides along the water. As the Nereid clears the final spit of frozen land, the seals frolic in the waves. Out in the open water, the submarine begins its dive. As waves wash over the great gray body of the sub, only the conning tower and the deck gun remain visible above the chilly Antarctic seas. Submerged, the Nereid glides smoothly into the ocean's depths. Inside the sub, Major Carter lies sleeping in the top bunk. Yoshizumi sits at the desk, absorbed in his work. Moving in his sleep, Carter knocks his diary from the bunk. Yoshizumi glances down to find a photograph peeking out of it. It's Carter with his wife and young son and daughter. Yoshizumi plucks the photograph from the diary and scrutinizes it while the major slumbers on. The scientist glances up sympathetically at the sleeping Carter, then back at the photograph, before sliding it back into the diary and placing it back on Carter's bunk.
You chaps all right?
Fine, thank you.
He certainly sleeps a lot, doesn't he?
I do sleep a great deal. We were speaking of it yesterday. We have never slept so much before.
I know.
Oh, good morning, Captain. When do we get to Washington?
Oh, you got 5 days more to sleep, Major.
That long?
It's still within your deadline, is it not?
Yes. But earthquakes do not always occur on schedule.
Maybe you should try it before, sir.
McLeod leaves the men's quarters. Carter hops down from his bunk and grimaces at Yoshizumi.
You got any more surprises for us?
Sub's radio mast and periscope slice through the surface waters of the Potomac River, just offshore from Washington, D.C. Inside the sub, a hypodermic needle punctures the diaphragm in a vial of Latour's experimental antidote. Carter thumbs the plunger to adjust the dosage. Wiping a cotton swab across his abdomen, he jabs the needle in. Watching, Yoshizumi sniffs nervously. Carter withdraws the needle and smiles.
Nothing to it.
Outside, the city sits lifeless on the bank of the river.
Washington, D.C., gentlemen.
McLeod steps aside to let Carter peer through the periscope. The Washington Monument sits centered in the lens. Carter pans the riverbank until a seven-storied building fills the viewfinder. Stepping back, he surrenders the periscope to Yoshizumi.
Take a look.
The scientist steps up to the viewfinder.
Major Carter, everything you need has been launched with the life raft.
Okay, we're going to be out.
He shakes hands with McLeod.
Good luck.
Thank you. Save a couple of beers for us.
Real or American?
I don't care as long as they're cold.
Grinning, Carter walks away. Yoshizumi steps up to take McLeod's hand. As the scientist moves on, McLeod's smile fades. Wearing scuba gear, Carter and Yoshizumi stand in the airlock as river water rushes up around them. The two men ascend from the Nereid toward the surface of the river. Below, McLeod peers into the periscope. In the viewfinder, he sees the two men motor for shore in the inflatable raft.
May God go with you.
Carter steers the raft beneath the bridge and heads upriver. Rounding the end of a pier, Carter points the craft to shore. On shore, a decomposing corpse sits slouched in an abandoned car. Dodging around derelict vehicles, the two men hurry beneath a freeway overpass. They move into the city and run, drawn by the dome of the Capitol building beyond the freeway. Past the freeway, Carter and Yoshizumi jog on toward the White House. Entering the lifeless front garden of the presidential home, they sprint across the untended lawn through chest-high, desiccated vegetation. Carter bounds up the stairs with Yoshizumi at his heels. As they dash to the top, the earth begins to shake.
What the hell? Is this it?
I don't think so. Not yet.
I hope you're right.
Carter finds the door locked.
Watch out.
Stepping back, he kicks it open. He and Yoshizumi dart inside and dash down the staircase. Leaping over a corpse on the floor, they find their path blocked by a set of metal shutters.
Here, take cover.
Clutching Carter's bag, Yoshizumi steps behind a bulkhead. Peering around a corner, he finds his partner shaping plastic explosive in his hands. Carter bends to press the charge into the shutters. Pulling a small timing and detonator device from a pouch on his belt, Carter applies it to the explosive. He turns the dial to set the timer. As it spins, he moves behind the bulkhead. Stepping over the rubble, Carter stops at the edge of an elevator shaft, only to find the car sitting at the bottom.
Are you afraid of heights?
Sometimes.
Well, can you handle this?
I must. We are running out of time.
All right. Let's go.
With gloved hands, Carter seizes a cable and steps into the shaft. Yoshizumi follows. Silhouetted by the light from above, the two men shimmy down the steel cables, deep into the bunker below the White House. From above, a ceiling panel is lifted out of the elevator car. Carter tosses his bag down into the car, then lowers himself through the opening. He reaches up to help Yoshizumi down. Outside the elevator, their passage is blocked. Carter throws his bag at the metal door, then waves his hand in front of the lens of a defunct security device, but to no avail. Jaw clenched in frustration, he steps to the door. Watching Carter apply a wad of explosive to the metal, Yoshizumi takes cover around a corner. As Carter sets the detonator into the charge, another tremor shakes the building. Carter spins the timer. As he sprints for safety, paneling collapses around him. The detonation knocks him off his feet and hurls him along the corridor. Darting forward, Yoshizumi stops at the sight of Carter on his back, impaled by a steel bar. He struggles to move the steel door pinning Carter's legs, but it's too heavy for him. Desperate, he grabs the bar protruding from Carter's chest. Tugging it free, he stumbles back and falls to his knees. The building shakes as another tremor hits.
No!
Leaving Carter where he lies, Yoshizumi struggles to keep his feet in the trembling building. Shaken by the earthquake, Carter grits his teeth in pain. As Yoshizumi races along the corridor, panels crash down from the ceiling. Knocked to the floor, he rolls out of harm's way. Springing to his feet, he charges into the control room where the map of the world still shines on the wall. Equipment explodes in a shower of sparks, sending him dashing back to the entrance. He spots the control panel in the adjacent room, its armed button brightly illuminated. As he reaches up to disarm the automatic reaction system, the red launch button illuminates. Yoshizumi scrambles to find an override and spins around to find the bank of video monitors showing a missile rising from its silo. Then another. As another missile is launched, Yoshizumi fumbles frantically with the control panel. He watches the monitors helplessly as more missiles rise from their launch pads to arc across the heavens. On the illuminated wall map, targets shine brightly all over the world. As Yoshizumi turns back to the video monitors, the ARS sends missile after missile streaking up into the brilliant blue sky. The skeletal remains of General Garland lie slumped in a chair by the console. Yoshizumi gets to his feet. His eyes dart to the corridor, where Carter lies thrashing about on the floor. He hurries to kneel by the dying man.
It's too late. Major Carter, it's too late!
Eyes wide with pain and fear, Carter struggles to comprehend, then sinks back to the floor. Yoshizumi lowers his head to the Major's chest. As Yoshizumi gaze down at the Major, Carter's eyes close. His trembling lips fall still. His head rolls to one side. Yoshizumi looks back at the control room, then down at the dead man in his arms. Pushing himself to his feet, he walks away wearily. Stopping in the corridor, he thinks for a moment, then shrugs out of his backpack. Kneeling, he pulls out a radio.
Narrate? Somewhere in narrate? This is Yoshizumi speaking. Over.
Yoshizumi, this is the Nereid. Over.
We were too late. Save yourselves if you can. We're on Prom Station to evacuate. We tried.
We all tried, Yoshizumi. We all tried.
There's just one more thing. Tell Dr. Latour. His vaccine seems to have worked. I guess that still matters.
At this point in time, life still matters. You stay where you are, you just might be safe. God willing.
Yoshizumi glances along the corridor where Carter's ravaged body lies tattered and bloody. He turns away to stare into the shadows of the control room. Dropping the radio, he slowly pulls himself into a sitting position at the entrance of the control room. There, he gazes across at the targets flashing on the map of the world. Outside, a blinding nuclear blast devastates Washington. A mushroom cloud towers above the atomized city. Mushroom clouds blossom around the globe. In New York City, in Rome, the deadly mushrooms rise, billowing into the sky. Years later, human skeletons lay strewn across the stony, slate-gray soil. Through the heat waves radiating upwards from the scorched, barren earth, a lone figure appears. Clad in tattered rags, the figure hobbles painfully over the rocky ground with the help of a slender walking stick. Crude, handmade sandals protect the pilgrim's feet from the parched, lumpy soil as he hobbles toward an abandoned mission. He stops in the doorway, his gaunt frame silhouetted against the glaring light of day. Leaning on his stick, the pilgrim limps into the shadowy gloom of the church. Skeletons mark where the monks died. With short, painful steps, the pilgrim shuffles deeper into the church, then stops. It's Yoshizumi. The figure of Jesus nailed to the cross, a crown of thorns on his head, lies tipped to the side. Yoshizumi steps forward, then squats in front of the crucifix. Yoshizumi gazes on the figure. "What are you doing?" he wonders silently. "Out here and all alone." The figure of Jesus gazes back. "You're not going to answer me? All right, I will find the way myself." Ignoring a skeleton beside the crucifix, Yoshizumi beats the dust from a rug plucked from the floor. "How did you survive?" he imagines the skeleton asking. Looking over at it, he replies, "I was underground and safe." "You seek others who are alive?" "Yes, further south are the woman and child I love." He holds Merritt's necklace. Smoke drifts from the chimney of a large shack sitting on a spit of land beneath a snow-capped mountain range. Inside the shack, a haggard Merritt sits at the window.
"Don't you understand? Winter is coming. We have very little food left."
The women and children listen lethargically to Latour.
"We should head north now."
"What's the point? The virus would kill us anyway."
"We've all had injections of my vaccine against the virus, which is why we survived the last 4 years."
"It doesn't matter."
Sad-eyed, Merritt slowly stands and walks toward the open door. Outside, she picks her way down the rocky bank at the water's edge, stooping to gather sticks for firewood. Stepping up onto a rock, she squats on her heels to stare down into the bleak expanse of water. Raising her eyes to gaze across the inlet, she stares incredulously along the waterline. In the distance, a figure lurches painfully across the stony beach. Watching him leaning on his stick, Merritt rises from her heels, her lip quivering. Sunlight glints off the necklace around the pilgrim's neck.
"Yoshizumi!"
Merritt drops her bundle of firewood.
"Yoshizumi! Yoshizumi!"
As she runs toward him, the other survivors pour out of the shack and onto the beach. Yoshizumi runs clumsily along the waterline as Merritt races toward him. Yards short of his goal, Yoshizumi tumbles to the ground. Merritt pulls him to his knees.
"Yoshizumi, you're alive! You are!
The ragged band of survivors rushes along the beach toward the couple. Yoshizumi holds Merritt in a tight embrace.
Life is wonderful.
This described version of Virus was created by Audio Vision Canada. The narrative description was written by Jim Fletcher and Bill Williams, narrated by Valerie Hunter.